Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It, produced by Foundersuite.com. Today, I am pleased to present Rand Fishkin of Spark Toro, coming to us from a smoky Seattle. How's it going there?
Well, parts per million in the atmosphere are not good, but everything else is all right. Thanks for having me, Nathan.
Are you feeling it? We were talking about this right before the call. I was in Boulder last week, and I was feeling it in my eyes, the smoke in my eyes and my nose. Are you feeling it up there in Seattle?
Oh, absolutely. If you go outside, and there's a lot of people, you know, wearing the masks, because if you're outside for more than 30 minutes a day, they're sort of, you know, it's like smoking 7 cigarettes every hour or something crazy.
Really? Wow. Yeah, interesting. Any inclination to just hop on a flight to Mazatlan or somewhere?
A small one. No, I've got a lot of obligations here in Seattle over the next few days. I think I'm going to Salt Lake City to speak at a conference on Friday, but
cool. Well, I hope it all gets put out. The fires get put out soon. It's crazy. All right, let's jump into this. I'm excited for this conversation. So tell us about Spark Toro. What do you guys do?
Well, right now we're still in the building process. I left my job at the end of February and started Spark Toro the next day, March 1st. We raised a round of funding in June, and we've been building a little bit of technology behind the scenes. We released a couple of free tools. So if anybody is in the web marketing world, we've got a couple of free tools for you on the, you know, sort of analyzing Twitter accounts and connecting your Twitter account, being able to see and use the URLs that you tweet to vote for content that should appear similar to Hacker News, but leveraging Twitter. And we are, eventually planning to build something that helps entrepreneurs and marketers discover the publications and people that influence their audiences. That's our eventual goal.
And the goal will be to better target my advertising if I have a better, you know, identification of my audience, or sort of what's the...
Advertising is one way that you could play this, but we want to be very broad, not extremely specific. So, for example, you might say, you know, you and I start a new company to sell high-tech restaurant equipment to chefs. Mm-hmm. And we say to each other, oh, man, what are the podcasts that chefs listen to? What events do they go to? Or which blogs do they read? And who do they follow on Twitter and LinkedIn and Instagram and Facebook, and what subreddits do they potentially pay attention to or read, or what YouTube channels do they subscribe to? All those kinds of questions are right now very frustrating, which is why the vast majority of marketers and new companies just throw a bunch of money at Google and Facebook, right? And they're like, you guys take care of it. We'll just toss the money at you. But of course, that's very inefficient and extremely expensive, right? Because everybody's doing it, the competition's really high, and so the ROI is really low. Yeah. And a lot of companies find that they can't affordably attract customers that way. And I think that, you know, many folks ignore opportunities like, hey, maybe I could pitch to be a guest on this podcast. Maybe I could email this, you know, blogger and see if I could post a guest piece. Maybe I could share this launch that I'm doing with this person on Twitter who reaches my audience really well. And those things are very much ignored because that data is inaccessible.
Yeah. Interesting. Cool. Do you have a target launch date? I know that's always a squishy question with startups, but do you have
I think we're aiming to have something that we can demo for people in maybe the January, February timeline, and then hopefully a public launch sometime next spring.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Great. And then just for anyone who's not familiar, there may be a few previews to this. You were at Moz, I know you were there a long time, and we don't need to go too deep into that, but maybe you want to just talk about what you were doing before and how you kind of came to this point you're at today.
Yeah. So I started a blog back in 2003 called SEO Moz, and that eventually became a consulting company and then later a software company. And in 2007, I became CEO, raised a round of funding, $1.1 million from some local investors here in Seattle, one venture firm and one private investment firm. And then over the next 7 years, scaled that up to about $30 million in revenue and 20,000-25,000-ish customers and almost 150 people. And then stepped down as CEO, stayed at the company for the next almost 4 years as an individual contributor and chairman of the board and sort of working a lot on product and marketing stuff. And over the last couple of years, had a lot of conflict with leadership, which I think many founders do when they are no longer CEO. And I left the company, well, let's see, sort of half left, half was asked to leave, you know, that kind of thing. somewhere in the middle of those. I stayed around for a year at the request of one of my investors and left in February, left February 28th. I did write a blog post about that and then started SparkToro on March 1st. And I had written a book called Lost and Founder, which you can probably see behind me there.
See it? Yep.
That came out in April and have done a bunch of, speaking and interviews and all that kind of stuff about Lost and Founder. And then we raised, as I mentioned, raised a round of funding, closed in June. And my co-founder and I have been sort of cranking on product and marketing stuff and all the other things that go along with the business since then. So that's basically me. Oh, and I think probably useful to your audience and especially with the topic of your podcast. So I raised that $1.1 million in 2007. I tried to raise rounds in 2009, 2010, and 2011 and failed to do so each year. So I have met with probably 100 venture capitalists over, you know, over my career. And then in 2012, finally did close a round with Foundry Group for $18 million. And then in 2016, my successor, who was my former chief operating officer, who's now the CEO, she raised an additional $10 million for that business from insiders.
Interesting.
Just Foundry and Ignition.
Fascinating. I mean, this could be a 3-hour podcast, but we will keep it shorter than that. Let me touch on a little bit briefly before we get to SparkToro's fundraising. Let me go to Moz. You know, I think it's fascinating that you tried and failed 3 times to raise VC. And then, you know, my question is really what changed in the business or in your pitch or in some other market dynamic in 2012 that helped you raise money?
Gosh. Well, let's see. I think that in 2009, and 10 probably, there were two factors working against us. One was no one believed that the size of the SEO market would be large. And no one believed that Moz would be sort of more than a few $1 million in revenue as a company. And just for reference today, it's about $50 million in revenue. I think the second piece there was that we had a small consulting arm. So we were providing some services. It was about 10% of our revenue, maybe a little more than that, 15%, not quite. And a bunch of investors told us, oh, you're like a services business.
Right.
We're not interested. We don't want to invest.
Yep.
And that actually biased us to shut down our consulting arm and to have no services revenue, which I think was almost definitely a mistake. And I think this is something I talk about in the book and have been talking about publicly for some time.
Yep.
There was just a really good article published on, I think it was Atrium Magazine Online that dove into this topic. But I think that a lot of founders and entrepreneurs foolishly, irrationally optimize their businesses to be able to raise more money. Mm-hmm. When in fact, that is not the goal of your business.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty dumb goal. Even if you're an investor, I think most investors would tell you, that is a dumb way to operate. Do not optimize your business to be able to raise more money from people like us. You should optimize your business to serve customers better, to make more revenue, to be more profitable. Well, yeah. Okay. Venture capitalists are not particularly interested in profit, but ignoring that particular aspect, right? To be able to grow faster. I think those are good, reasonable, logical, true north directions. Optimizing for fundraising is not, but I spent years doing it. We dropped our consulting business. We tried to, we worked really hard on retention. So we went up market rather than going down market, which probably would have been smarter, be more accessible. I think that would have gotten us more growth. I like serving the down market customers more. I think there's way more of them. I think there's tremendously more opportunity there. And I think we could have, brought many of those folks up in pricing over time. It also prevented us, not prevented us, but biased us against doing something like having a significant onboarding team, which we felt like, well, that, that could be viewed as services. Yeah. And if we charge for that, it could be a problem, that kind of thing. Only to see, very successful companies like HubSpot, once they had raised, many of their rounds, then they sort of quietly built these, giant sales and onboarding machines that were extremely effective at customer acquisition and retention, right? I think we ignored doing one-time pricing, one single-use pricing, which was also probably really dumb and cost us a lot in the market because people went to competitors and started figuring out their, all these other different ways to get around that problem because many people feel like they have a one-time problem with SEO.
Yeah.
And I think we would have done very well to be able to help them solve it. And then the next time they have it and the next time they have it, they would have come back to us again and again. So a lot of, a lot of lessons learned, but I do worry significantly about the current startup. And this has been true for 20 years, right?
Yeah.
We have all optimized for how do I get venture capitalists to like me?
For sure.
And you don't need venture capitalists like you. You need you to like you. You need your friends to like you. You need your coworkers to like you. And most of all, you need your customers to like you. And that's not the game we've been playing.
So perfect segue. So you're doing things differently with SparkToro. And, we will link to the blog post, which I think is really great on there. But let's talk about it as well. So you're doing things differently. You're kind of approaching it a little bit differently. If I were to paraphrase, you're not doing the bootstrapping path. You're not doing the optimized for VC path. You're kind of blazing your own new trail here. So how would you describe your thoughts about financing SparkToro? Yeah.
My co-founder and I got together and we said, hey, do we have enough money to be able to bootstrap this thing by ourselves? And our guess was probably not, right? We probably have to, do consulting or build something different than what we wanted to build and try and launch that very quickly, try and, get some early revenues, those types of things. And we also at the same time realized, hey, mostly thanks to the reputation I had at Moz and a lot of the relationships there, I had the freedom and I don't know what you want to call it, privilege, right? Opportunity, luck, to be able to forge a new path, right? To be able to say, hey, I want to structure an investment deal that is very different. So we decided that that's what we wanted to do rather than try and, fully bootstrap. And we knew we didn't want to go the institutional capital route, at least certainly not early in our company's trajectory, because who knows what kind of company this will be. And we don't want success to only mean, $100 million to $1 billion outcome or die trying. And I think the odds, someone just did a nice study of all the companies that have ever gone through, I think it was either Y Combinator or Techstars, applied and gone through.
Mm-hmm.
And 96% failed to return the minimum capital requirements for their investors. So your odds are terrible. The day you take venture, your odds go from pretty good, 50% 5-year survival rate to 4% return, at or above investors' expectations for capital returns, which I think is like 3 to 5x over 7 years, something like that. So we decided we wanted this different path. And we talked to our attorney, Joe Wallen, who actually, he helped create the crowdfunding laws in Washington, which have allowed a bunch of cool businesses to flourish, mostly breweries, actually, of all things.
Hey.
And we structure around that, that has a few unique aspects. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one is SparkToro is an LLC, not a C corporation, which is very unusual. The conversion is pretty easy if we ever need to do it, but that's one. We, in any given year, when we make profits, the first sort of $1.3 million, which is how much we raised, 1X, goes back to our investors, right? Mm. And you know, obviously in any year, we'll cover their taxes as well. And then after that, everyone participates pro rata in the profits of the business. We can also make the decision in any given year to reinvest, you know, a certain amount of the profits or not. But this gives our investors sort of a, you know, similar to a liquidity preference, but and they do have that as well. But this ability to participate in the company's ongoing profitable growth, and thus our investors can make, you know, let's say SparkToro makes 5 years from now, it's a $4 million a year business that's growing at 10 or 15% year over year. So what a venture capitalist would call extremely uninteresting, not at all interesting, not useful, not. But our investors can actually make a lot more from a $4-4.5 million a year business that's growing at 15% than they would from most of their angel and angel type investments that do raise venture. So
interesting. Yeah. No, let's pick on that a little bit. So the profits go, but let's say you earned $100,000 in profits. Mm-hmm. The pro rata, that means everyone gets their equal share, but talk about the 1X distribution. How does that actually work? What would, of that $100,000 in profits, what's going to investors first?
Right. So in the case that we, let's say we had $100,000 in profits in 2019, and that we decided to pay out, right? That we said, hey, we're not using this for the growth of the company. We're going to pay this out in profits. That $100,000 would all go to our investors.
Okay.
So would the next $1.2 million in profits. After they've all been paid back their initial investment sum, then additional profits accrue pro rata.
I understand.
So, you know, I think, you know, some of our investors own 2% of the company or 5% of the company or 5% of the unit shares in the LLC. So they would, for example, get, you know, in a $100,000 a year, they'd get $5,000 their share of the profit.
This, so the next question would be, do the investors have any influence on whether to reinvest or pay out? Because that's obviously a big factor, right? Do you sink all that money back into the business or do you distribute it? Yeah,
that. So I think this is one of the lucky privileges that I've got. That is exclusively my decision.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And I think that, you know, that's just something where investors have to have a tremendous amount of trust. But also, you know, most of our investors put between $30,000 and $75,000. If you put $100,000 in, I think that was very affordable for them and or very doable for them. And also, you know, I know and they know, and I think the market knows that if it doesn't go well, it's going to be very unlikely that I would be able to raise more money in the future. Certainly from those folks and maybe from a lot of folks. So, you know, there's a lot riding on it. But we're also optimizing to have the best chance of success that we can. So keeping it, you know, for example, keeping the company really tiny. It's just the two of us. Mm-hmm. We both work remotely from home, so we're not paying for an office or even WeWork space or something like that. We are spending next to nothing. You know, Amazon, of course, reached out with their, oh, well, AWS will offer you, you know, $150,000 in credits and whatever. Great. Yeah. Awesome. We'll take that. We won't have to pay for our hosting and processing costs for a long time.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot of nice things going for us. I think we've spent very, very little of our $1.3 million and want to have the maximum runway that we can to be able to get this, you know, to profitability and then look for profitable growth. That might be quick, but mm-hmm. it might be slow. And we're comfortable with both of those.
It's kind of funny. It reminds me a little bit of Kevin O'Leary on the Shark Tank, right? His deals are always a little untraditional. They're always like royalty, or he'll be like, you know, I'll loan you the $500,000, you pay me back 3X and no equity, right? His deals are often like sort of what you're describing here. So it's kind of fun to hear it with a real startup.
Yeah, and I wish that there were more of this. I think that the world, our world of startups is so centered on this one single model that is clearly, right, obviously wrong for 96% of the companies that take it.
Yeah.
Right. And venture capitalists, right, and the LPs that put money into them are okay with it because the model sort of works. Although, you know, even venture capital firms, I think only a third of them actually beat the market, right, and return more than what their LPs would have made if they put it into, you know, an index fund or those kinds of things. So this model is a little bit weird right now. And I think that it's a market that's a bit out of whack. I would love to see, you know, 5 to 10 other forms of common capital investment make their way into the technology startup world. I think that would allow a lot more companies to flourish. My sense is that there's a ton of businesses that could be successful if they didn't kill themselves trying to grow at a maximum rate and, you know, end up having to, well, our, you know, our burn rate is this, but we need it to be this because we've got to grow faster, as opposed to, hey, we could be a profitable business tomorrow and then use those profits and sort of be the tortoise and not the hare.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm going to connect you to someone. We did a interview with a guy named Bill Babel of Pingboard. He's a startup down in Austin, and he's got a lot of similar thoughts and concepts. So I think you'd appreciate, you know, connecting with him.
I'd love to.
So he's kind of on a mission to also create like the third approach, right? Or cool. All right. Let's talk about actually raising this round. So, I mean, it sounds like you went to mostly people you already knew. I think the blog post said you talked to about 47 folks and 35 of them came on. Is that right?
That is correct. Although I think that I've had a couple conversations with some of the 12 who didn't come on. And I think that perhaps I was a little too subtle in my request. You know, I don't know if you've ever done this, Nathan, but man, it is so awkward to ask your rich friends for money. Like, that's a real, you know, just kind of, ooh.
Yeah.
Those emails are hard to type, hard to hit send on. I never felt comfortable with that. And so I think there was, you know, a little bit of, I should have been a little more, I don't know, comfortable in my own shoes.
They didn't know you were actually asking for money. They thought you were just talking about your business or something.
Yeah. I mean, there was one guy in particular who you know, emailed me and he was sort of like, hey, how come you didn't offer to, you know, to have me invest or ask me, because he saw who else was. Uh-huh. And I was like, wait, but I emailed you and said, hey, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, we're going to be doing fundraise and da da da. And when are you around? And you offered to introduce me to some folks. And I assumed offer to introduce me to some folks. That means he's not interested.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe I should have been more obvious, more blatant.
I feel like I've got better about asking people directly for money the more times I've failed fundraising, right? There's a correlation.
Oh, interesting. I think I never felt particularly, well, I shouldn't say never. In my 2010 and 2011 attempts after the 2009 sort of failure, I definitely got much more comfortable at asking, you know, professional investors for their money. I think this was more of a, you know, oh, I know these people socially or professionally or through other folks that I know socially or professionally, and I'm reaching out. And that was more difficult, right? Because in a few cases, right, you know, I'd ask some friends and they'd sort of be like, oh, actually, we don't have that kind of money to be able to do that. And then you have that, like, oh, sorry, I shouldn't even know your finances. I feel very uncomfortable about that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. You make assumptions that, oh, this guy or gal worked early at Twitter or something, but they were lousy negotiators when they were negotiating their stock options or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, in the case, I will say this, one of the things that really frustrated me and also, you know, was just infuriating as a systemic societal issue is I talked to a number of women about investing in SparkToro. And even though many of them had similar careers as the men I talked to, almost, you know, almost to a person, they had not made as much money in their early, you know, from their stock at, you know, whatever, Google, Yelp, Uber, Facebook,
yeah,
you know, these technology companies. And I had this sense like, oh, wait, I am seeing the systemic, you know, sort of sexism where women are underpaid for the same roles as, you know, 5 or 7 years later, 10 years later, they don't have the, you know, their stock is not as high, or they didn't get as much stock as many stock options and that kind of thing for the same type of work. And that was eye-opening and frustrating.
All right. Let's just a few more questions about that angel round. You know, so you circulate what you're doing to 47 of your friends, 35 of them come on. Was there any other, you know, unusual attributes in how you raised it other than just kind of circulating some of your docs and
Well, so, I mean, one interesting thing was, I think probably I got, you know, 20-ish yeses from friends and then, and I should say friends and professional colleagues. And then, those folks oftentimes, you know, would connect me with someone else. Right. So, you know, CEO of Zillow, who I know a little bit, Spencer Raskoff, introduced me to, an Amazon guy, and a couple other people who then said, hey, you know, if Spencer's putting money in and, given your background with Moz, we're very interested, you know, I'd like to put some money in.
Yeah.
And that happened a number of times. So I think I personally know maybe a little more than half of my investors. I would also say one of the things that we did in this unusual round was, and I think I would recommend this to anybody else who's doing this. I got this advice from one of the first people I talked to about the investment, Dan Shapiro, who's the CEO at Glowforge. And basically Dan said, hey, you know, my recommendation is I want to put money in. Like I'm supportive, but I think that what you should do is form a tentative structure, make a single page term sheet that's real simple.
Yep.
And then show that to, you know, the 3 or 4 people who you're most confident in, myself included, you know, want to invest. We'll give you feedback, right? We'll tell you like, hey, this thing doesn't feel quite fair, or this feels a little funny, or this, you know, doesn't work as well as we'd like, those kinds of things. Great. We did exactly that. I think because of that, you know, because those 4 or 5 folks gave us feedback, we took it back to Joe, our attorney, you know, Joe put it in the documents. And then as we were going through everyone else, we had very little friction.
Interesting.
You know, when you have experienced investors who are looking at your docs and your structure, and giving you feedback on that, I think that, you know, a handful of those people early on can make a big difference, especially if they're not only giving you feedback, but then saying, okay, now based on how you've modified this, I'm in for 50K, 100K, 30K, whatever it is.
Did you do since you're an LLC, was this a convertible or a note or a priced round, or what's this actual structure?
Priced round, yeah. We talked about doing convertible note, but convertible notes really rely on the fact that you're going to raise again in the future.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And we did not want to commit to that. We felt like, hey, we could probably get a convertible note done, but it would be dishonest. It wouldn't be the truth, right? The truth is that's probably never going to convert, or it's not going to convert in the way that angel investors are used to things like that converting. And so we did a priced round. Yeah.
And so, not to get too into the technical details, sure, but it would be ownership units, right? I mean, LLC. Yeah. Yeah. Is that how it works?
That's exactly right. Ownership units, similar to how a lot of law firms or professional services firms work on their, both on the investment and partner side.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Got it. All right. Awesome. Cool. And I think I saw you've open sourced some of the docs. So if anyone wants to check it out, they can see your extra term sheet and stuff like that.
Yeah. That's right. We have our documents available in a Google Drive folder that's open to anyone. You can find the link via the blog post. We've had, I think, 3 other entrepreneurs now use the documents. They modified them with their own attorneys, but you know, it can save you a lot of money, because if you want a structure like this, you know, you've got a public list of, hey, these, you know, 35, 36 people already trusted this structure to work well for them. And, you know, SparkToro is using it. And you can save a ton of the time that you would spend, you know, doing a putting together something like this with your attorneys.
So 35 investors, that's definitely a party round. Did you ever think about doing the ultimate party round of like crowdfunding this, doing equity crowdfunding?
Actually, that was exactly our plan. If the sort of the first four or five folks that we talked to had not been very on board with it, our plan was to do a crowdfunding round. And that's, it's a little more complicated for software products, but I think we could have pulled something off. And certainly, you know, one of the things that's nice is that I've got a big network, right? A lot of people following me. So I think this is one of the other things that, you know, folks, I think folks who've looked at this round have given the fair criticism of, look, Rand, you can do this because,
you
know, whatever, you're a late 30s white dude in Seattle, in the United States, you know, who has a career in history and, you know, all these things, right, that are working in your favor. And this would be very hard for anyone else. And I think that in a lot of ways, that's very fair criticism. The one thing I would say, and the big piece of advice that I have is if you can build up an expertise, a talent, a skill that is very useful to lots of other people in the startup world and help them over the course of your, you know, first years of your career, raising money is going to be tremendously easier. Because they already know you, they've worked with you, they like you, they trust you, they've seen how, you know, smart you are about this particular topic.
That can
definitely go a long way.
What are you thinking? You know, I know you're focused really on getting product out there and you know, launch and all that stuff. Are you even thinking ahead towards raising more money? Or that'll totally be something you cross when the growth demands it? Or do you think you could build this whole thing on the 1.3? I don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, this definitely our hope is that we can build the whole thing on the 1.3. So, you know, with Moz, in 2007, I raised this, you know, $1.1 million round. The next year after we sort of launched the product that we were building with that money, we became profitable sort of the month after we launched it. And we were profitable for another 4 years, right, of growth, getting to $30 million in revenue. Now, I don't want to say that, you know, for sure I can absolutely easily do that again. I think that, you know, Moz lucked out in terms of Google was, you know, this rocket ship that was growing and SEO became more and more important. And who knows, you know, perhaps audience intelligence or you know, the sort of modern version of PR will become more important and have a big trend that it rides, but maybe not, right? I can't be certain, but I definitely think, I know that it's possible to ride a growth wave profitably. Right. Mm-hmm. I've been able to do that before. And I certainly want to be able to do that again. But I'm not completely ruling out the possibility that we might raise investment in the future. I think closing doors is dumb, which is why I didn't raise venture, because venture closes a lot of doors for an early company.
Yeah. When you think about, like, if you vision yourself raising from VCs, do you get a pit in your stomach? I mean, I don't know. Like, you've been through some interesting cycles and some interesting, you know, I don't know. You can pass on this question too, if you
want. No, I don't think I get the pit in my stomach. I will say this. I really, really love helping small businesses and small companies and individual investors, you know, who maybe have a couple million dollars and or $1 million, right? And they're able to invest 25K. And I'm not so excited about, you know, hey, I'm going to take this person who's in the top 0.1% of income earners and the fund behind them, and I'm going to help make them even richer.
Right.
You know, I don't get totally excited about that. Right. I think that's, I'm not a fan of, you know, sort of economic concentration of wealth. I think that's generally a bad thing. So I don't have like a strong desire for Moz or SparkToro to become a monopoly. I think competition is really good. But, you know, if you're a venture capitalist, you want to invest in monopolies.
Right.
That's what you're doing. So, you know, I think there's a bit of a values mismatch and a sort of economic share of the pie mismatch, and also a, you know, closing doors versus leaving them open mismatch.
Yeah, no, that's fair. All right, one more sensitive question, and again, you're welcome to pass. You know, when you left Moz, did the VCs have control of your board? I mean, I read the blog. It sounded like you were, again, sort of not pushed out, but not totally welcome. I mean,
right, somewhere in the middle.
And I mean, independent of you, I always tell startups, like, if you raise money, you know, founders get fired. I've worked with companies in the past where the founders are actually pushed out, and I tell them to envision that, like, you put your blood, sweat, and tears into something, and then you're pushed out. So I'm not implying that, but I guess the question is, was there a control issue that was painful? Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, no. So you're absolutely right. There were many control issues that were painful for me. Right. Substantively disagreed with all sorts of, you know, personnel decisions and strategic decisions and product decisions, in little ways and in big ways, and did not, you know, I think when folks hear, oh, chairman of the board and, you know, owns a fifth of the company, like, you must have some influence. And I guess the only real influence that I have is that technically people have to be in a room with me once a quarter. Right. And not even that. Right. I think sometimes the board meeting gets canceled. Right. But the true influence comes from sort of the relationships that you have. So, you know, if you have very positive relationships with your investors and they like you and trust you and sort of give you the benefit of the doubt, then, you know, then you have that. And if insiders in the company disagree, it's the CEO's call.
Yeah.
Right? It just is. And so, when I was CEO, I was, you know, I felt like, I was very aligned with my chief operating officer, and sort of after those roles changed, slowly over time, that became less and less the case. And, you know, and then it was her, you know, it was her call, right? She's the CEO, the board backs her. And, you know, and my job is, I think at that point, just to provide input and hope that some of it is useful.
Yeah. No, it's very fair. All right, great. Cool. I think we've covered a lot here. This is good. Any other just general guidance, tips for founders? The question I often ask is, if you were going to counsel your younger self, what would you do differently? You've been around doing this for so long, that might be a a long question, but like any just general like thoughts or comments? Yeah.
No. I mean, that's kind of exactly what I'm doing now, right? I'm doing what I wish I could have done as my younger self, which is just leave a lot of doors open.
Yeah.
And have more optionality about my business.
Yeah.
I think so. One thing I would definitely say, and you know, a lot of this is obviously in the book too, but one thing I would definitely say with many startups is I think that we get overly excited about whatever hot trends exist, right? So if you know, cryptocurrency is very hot, there's, you know, 1,000 crypto startups. If computer, you know, vision is hot, there's, you know, 1,000 of those. I have found that my anecdotal experience has been that when you pursue an unsexy, non-hot field, there is a lot less competition, a lot more potential revenue, a lot more opportunity, and very often, when it's not sexy, your odds of lasting go way up.
Sure. Yeah. That's interesting. Good contrarian thought there. I like it. All right, my man, this is great. So for people who want to learn more about SparkToro, it's just sparktoro.com, correct?
Yep. That's right.
And then what else would you like to plug here? Your book, Lost in Founder.
Sure. I mean, I think, if you're an entrepreneur or an early stage founder, I hope Lost and Founder resonates with you. I think certainly you can read what lots of other folks have thought about it online and see if it's a good match for you. The only other thing I'd say is that if I can be helpful, especially in terms of on this funding stuff, the SparkToro blog has got that open source documents around the raise.
Yep.
And you can follow me on Twitter at RandFish, where I'm most active.
Awesome. Great. Lost and Founder, that's just on Amazon, or where can they get that?
Yep, sure. Powell's, Amazon, IndieBooks, wherever books are sold.
I be honest, I haven't checked it out yet, but did you get an agent and go through, or did you self-publish?
Yeah. No. Got the whole agent. I published with Penguin Random House.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Great. Yeah. Awesome. Good stuff. This has been fun. Thanks so much. I love this new path. We need to coin a phrase for it, right? Like some sort of like.
Oh, I think, Jennifer Brandel and Mara Zepeda out of Portland have actually already coined something. They call it Zebras Not Unicorns.
Ah, okay.
And if you check out the Zebras Not Unicorns movement, there's a great website and a conference that they put together. And I actually asked if I could use the Zebras Not Unicorns sort of graphic on SparkToro's about page, because I think that's what we want to be. We want to be a zebra.
Zebras Not Unicorns. I love it. Great. All right. On that note, thank you, Ran. Appreciate it. And catch you after the next fundraising event, if that happens, or maybe not. Okay.
Maybe not. Yeah. If I fundraise, I hope to fundraise from customers.
That's great. Yeah. Cool. All right. Awesome. Thank you, sir.
Take care, Nathan. Bye.